And welcome back to the second half of The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. Texas is a state that is frequently understood, misunderstood by the rest of the nation, and there's good reason for that. Many Texans don't really understand Texas either, but somehow we get by just fine. In fact, Erica Greeter says Texas is thriving. She's cracking the Texas nut in her new book, Big, Hot, Cheap, and Right, What America Can Learn from the Strange Genius of Texas. We invite you to join the conversation. You want to talk about Texas? The number is 614-8980. You could also email questions to and comments to the source at tpr.org. Go to the comments section on our website, tpr.org. And welcome to The Source, Erica Greeter.
Thanks for having me.
Big, Hot, Cheap, and Right, What America Can Learn from the Strange Genius of Texas. And I wonder, is it a strange genius of Texas, or is it the idiot savant of genius of Texas?
Well, I think that's a fair question. We wanted to say strange genius. I think there's been such success that you want to, it does have an interesting cast to it, but we said strange because people will think that anything we're doing right is strange. So
you're going around the country. I've seen you on Morning Joe. People are asking you questions about Texas, and they want to know, they really do want to know what Texas is doing right and how we're able to create jobs. And your answer is?
Well, as you say, I've been going all around, and I'm happy to have a chance to do so because I think part of why I wanted to write the book was, you know, you recall back in 2011 during that brief and ill-fated Perry presidential campaign. That was, you know, a period of intense focus on the state and what's been happening in the state, especially on the economic side. And there was almost this tendency not to believe it was true or that it could be true or that if it was true, it was just some kind of freak accident and it was about oil money, oil jobs, or minimum wage jobs, or so on. So I think what we've seen in the state has been a lot more positive than the kind of caricatures suggest. There's been a sustained period of population growth, economic growth, and we can see that in top-line macroeconomic numbers. The state GDP has grown from about $800 trillion in 2002 to about $1.1 trillion now. Sorry, $800 billion. And it's also played out in terms of the economic indicators that affect our day-to-day life. Unemployment's been lower than the national average every month for the last 6 years. Per capita personal income, median household income are about 97% of the national average, and we have a lower cost of living. We have affordable housing. We have growth in all of our cities, including six of the 20 biggest cities in the country. So, overall, I think it's been a very, very good decade for us.
Texas also has the highest percentage of workers earning minimum wage or less, 7.5% in 2012, higher except for the state of Idaho.
It's true. I talk about that in the book because I think that is problematic. Even if you are in a state with a low cost of living like we are in Texas, if you earn the minimum wage, and ours is set to the federal minimum wage, you're going to feel pretty poor. I mean, that's about $15,000 a year, and that's not a very good sum of money, no matter where you live. I think that we could raise the minimum wage. I think a state like this that has a growing population and a growing workforce could afford to do that without worrying about job loss, and I think it would be fair to do, too, because if you're working full-time, you shouldn't be living below the federal poverty line. That just doesn't sit right with me or with a lot of Texans, I think.
Now, you've covered the Texas legislature, People are wondering if we're able to come up with a Texas solution for the Obamacare, somehow, you know, expanding health care coverage in the state.
It's true. I think what we'll end up doing, and of course there's been this sort of push-pull. We're one of the states that has been saying, or the governor's been saying, we don't want this expansion. And in the ledge, you hear kind of a different rhetoric, which is interesting. You hear people say, we're not taking this expansion of Medicaid unless or until certain, you know, restrictions are met, certain Texas ideas are put in there. So I think what will happen in the end is we'll end up taking, you know, the federal money. It would be kind of, you know, foolish not to, given that as a state we spend so much money on uninsured care in the emergency rooms. You can calculate that. It's billions of dollars a year. But I think they're going to try to hold out for a little bit of flexibility so we can do it according to Texas parameters.
So you're saying it still could happen. There's, 27 days left in the session?
It's less than a month. And actually, it's funny because I've been doing this book tour kind of, you know, right in the middle of session. We had the book date scheduled to come out April 23rd. So it's been great because we're looking at politics a lot, but I'm also having this feeling of, I don't know what happened today in the ledge. I'm kind of worried. I just read today that, you know, the House is trying to fund the water bill, and then there was something in the house where they might not fund it after all. So there's a little bit of, you know, I'll double check this after we talk and put it on Twitter if I'm wrong. But I think what I've, my sense in the past few days has been that there's going to be some effort to figure out how to go forward with this.
Yeah, so
but only on Texas terms.
The water bill was using the rainy day fund to fund some drought projects, which is, you know, kind of appropriate names for that. And, but then it fell through a parliamentary procedure, and it may come back. But it has to, the budget has to be solidified first before they can move forward on that, it looks
right.
like.
Right. And what I understand, I think that you need 100 votes in the ledge or in the House to get money taken out of the rainy day fund. And I think that Republicans, it was bipartisan contention because some Republicans didn't want to spend the money in the first place, the more fiscally conservative Tea Party-leaning Republicans. And then some Democrats said, hey, if we're going to take money out of rainy day for water, we should take it out for schools. And in fact, if you're taking out for water, you're not going to have money to take out for schools. So that was, you know, their objection to that.
So
and I kind of understand. Oh, sorry.
You go ahead.
Well, you know, I understand. I mean, the thing is, if you think about the state budget, it's like a very, very small pie, right? So and we do a lot with it. We're pretty efficient as the state goes. But in a lot of these questions, I think you can get people saying, yeah, we want to do schools, we want to do water, we want to do Medicaid expansion, but we already carve a bigger slice of that small pie for public schools, for higher ed, and for Medicaid. So it's hard because given how small the budget is overall, if you're talking about spending more on schools, unless you have a way to get more revenue into the system, that often means implicitly you're saying we'll take it out of public schools or we'll take it out of higher ed. There's not a lot of low-hanging fruit in the state budget.
Right, because we don't have a state income tax, and I don't think that'll ever change. There's too many backstops built into the Texas government
right.
to keep something like that from ever happening. But we do have some pretty good sizable loopholes where businesses are able to not pay, you know, their share.
I think it's right. I think the income tax, we're one of the lowest tax burdens in the country, third or fourth lowest. I think there's some things we could do, though. I think things like former Governor Ratliff has called recently to, you know, restructure the margins tax. It was meant to be revenue neutral in 2005. We'll lower property taxes across the state, but we'll make it up in.
And that's a business tax. That's a business tax.
Right. The margins or franchise tax, it's called. And it was meant to be that the money that was cut due to the property tax cuts would be, you know, retaken in by the business tax. And so we haven't actually seen it happen. We've seen a sort of multi-billion-dollar hole in every budget since then because the margins tax isn't bringing in as much money as they thought it would initially. So I think we could maybe fix that to do what it was intended to do and bring in that money.
And still some people challenging that as a state income tax almost for businesses.
Yeah, and I think some people have said, you know, why don't we do it altogether? So I think I wouldn't go that far. I don't think we need to cut taxes any further. I also get emails from people saying property taxes are too high in the state, and they are pretty high in the state. But the thing is, the overall tax burden is one of the lowest in the country because of the lack of an income tax. We're one of the few states that doesn't have that. So I think we all have ideas about tax policy. We have a sales tax that's not higher than the national average, but it is a big part of our overall budget. Sales taxes in general are pretty regressive, so I don't think we want to go any higher on that. We could do things like small taxes somewhere else. Somebody had suggested in the ledge this session a soda tax. I think that was a good idea because, you know, soda is not a necessity, but it's popular. I buy soda, you buy soda. And if we, you know, put a small tax on that, a penny per ounce, we might mitigate some consumption of soda and
okay.
we bring in some revenue along the way.
Erica, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll have some more conversations about Texas and the policy track that we're on right now. Join the conversation, 614-8980. This is The Source on KSTX. This is The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about big, hot, cheap, and right. That is the state of Texas, what America can learn from our Lone Star State. And it's been doing business and creating jobs. And the author of that book is a Texas Monthly editor, Erica Greeter. Erica, I also read, and I thought about it as I read your book, Gail Collins' book, As Texas Goes, How the Lone Star State Hijacked the American Agenda. Two different books talking about the same topic. So did you think about that at all?
I did. You know, I read her book before. I read it while I was writing mine, I guess. My book's not a response to hers. My sense in reading hers, I think it might have initially started life as a book about what Perry would do as president if he was president. because I think her view seems to be that Texas is going to foist some of its policies on the country, which, you know, we actually don't really do and can't really do. If other states want to take some cues from Texas, they can, but that's otherwise not how it works. But I don't know. What was your opinion, David? You've read both.
I thought that she got a lot wrong, that she was an outsider writing about Texas, and she missed a lot of things. You cover a lot of history and give a lot of background in Texas, trying to explain where the attitudes come from. There are some things I could debate you about, but you know, you think you're right on the money about certain things, about why we have a government that's the way it is, which is basically a kind of a weak government, but it's also set up in a way to keep the population. It's a non-populist style government. Mm-hmm. It's to enforce the powers that be, the status quo.
Well, it's interesting because, and we've sort of seen, because the states had that approach for a long time, that there's almost this shadow state, is what I call it in the book, of alternative players who do some things that in other states the government might do. So starting with, you know, back in the Republic of Texas, you had churches playing a pretty active role in trying to encourage good behavior among citizens by saying, pay your debts, go to school, et cetera. You had Texas Rangers, who were sort of quasi-governmental ad hoc justice enforcers. And, of course, you have the private sector, which has been, for Texas, always, you know, this is huge analog to what government does. They play an active role in policy. They lobby. They talk about things the state needs. Right now in this session, they've been talking about the need for more investment in our schools and in our roads and in our water. So I think that other states don't have that same balance of a small government matched with a pretty strong private sector and civil society.
So what America can learn from the strange genius of Texas, and to me it seemed like reading your book, the three things are have low regulation, low taxes, have oil, and be next to Mexico are the three things that every state should have. I mean, because Texas really benefited from being next to Mexico. We have, especially during this era of growth, Mexico's was growing as well, and Texas benefited from that. And also we have the supply of cheap labor, which pretty much subsidizes every aspect of our life.
Well, I think that's right. And certainly, you know, trade with Mexico has grown precipitously since NAFTA was passed. But, I mean, you could put that in the other direction, too, and say Texas has unique challenges as well as unique strokes of luck. So with Mexico, it's good that we're close to an international border, and it's good that we're close to the sea. We have huge ports in Texas. But you could also say we have a 1,200-mile land border with a developing country, and we've had to manage that and do a lot of work with that and be quite aware of those issues. And we have a huge state, so we have different areas of the state. We have every kind of physical climate. We need a lot more infrastructure than in smaller states, than more compact states. So I think, you know, any state could look at its set of assets and challenges and think about its own approach. I wouldn't say that Texas has been successful purely because of luck of where it is and what it has.
So the Texas Observer reviewed your book, and they called you an apologist for some of the right-wing policies that we have in Texas that some people have seen as being kind of cruel and cold-hearted.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I was expecting the Observer of anybody to have a sort of critical take. My feeling is if we make the perfect, the enemy of the good, we're going to have a good chance of getting neither, right? So if I'm looking at things like how's the middle class doing in this state, how are the workers doing in this state, I see the data that supports good outcomes are being realized across Texas routinely. And this, the idea that we should be doing everything all at once or we're going to be able to address every problem all at once, I think is unrealistic, and I try to stay pretty close to what reality will allow. I think certainly going forward, we have challenges to look at in Texas. The big one I would cite is poverty. Our poverty rate's not really that much higher than the national average. We're about 17%. National average is about 14.5%. But it's too high in Texas and too high around the country, and a lot of the challenges we have are outcomes of poverty. So I think that going forward, we'll want to pay attention to these kinds of things, but luckily we're in a position where we can put more attention to these issues because we have come from behind and caught up now.
One thing about Texas is this rejection of the nanny state. The perfect anecdote for that is Rick Perry vetoing the texting while driving law that went through the last legislature. And here we are in Texas. If I want to text and drive, then by golly, I'm like, there shouldn't be a law keeping me from doing so.
There are some of these laws that become so sort of contentious, and it's surprising, isn't it? Because, you know, I think a barrier to texting while driving, I'm okay with that. I wouldn't take it as a huge affront to my personal liberty, but I guess there are some people who see it differently, so there we are.
And so there are folks who want Texas to change its political stripes and become blue. What do you see that the forecast for the battleground Texas?
Well, I think it's certainly possible. Certainly a lot of the demographics favor that happening, not just ethnicity, which is what kind of always attracts the attention, but I think the urbanization of the state. We're increasingly living in cities and rather than rural areas, and the youth of the state. I mean, it's a very young state, younger than the national average. We have a lot of kids in the state and a lot of young adults, and in Texas and around the country, you see young adults have different views on certain issues, and you also see that kids, because they don't work, they need investment, they need public schools, they need to have schools that are good enough to prepare them for the jobs we're going to have in the future. So I think those conditions favor Democrats. But there are some barriers still. One is that they haven't been running a lot of strong statewide candidates in recent years. They have a number on the bench, but when they start coming out of the gate, they'll have to introduce Texas Democrats across a huge state. I mean, six major cities, 22 media markets, that's expensive and it requires a lot of work. So I think I would say in 2018 we might see some shift over. 2014, probably not.
Yeah, the Democrats have the chicken and the egg kind of a problem. What comes first, the grassroots or the candidates? That's their conundrum. Let's go to the phones. Kelly is on the line. Kelly, welcome to The Source.
Hello. I'm calling because I was interested in the title of the book. I'm a Texan, and I spent 20 years living in California and New York. And it seems to me that you're sort of singing, preaching to the choir there. Like, we're always accused of being full of bluster and bravado, and that's the attitude toward Texas outside of Texas. And I wonder, I mean, do you actually plan that anybody's going to read this book who's not a Texan? I mean, it's funny that you go from this show, the previous topic, where you were talking about environmental air quality, and there's a lot of regulation that could be done to improve that, but not with the attitude of big, hot, cheap, and right.
Okay, Kelly, thank you for your call. Erica, tell me, any reaction?
Well, I think there's certainly a line, right, between hubris and confidence. And I think if you look at polling data, it's not just a sentiment that I'm describing from anecdotes. I mean, you can see in polls, I think the Texas Lyceum had one last year, that Texans feel pretty confident about the future of the state, and they say that they think the state economy is doing better than the national economy by about three quarters, for example. So I think that is significant, and I don't think it's necessarily an adverse thing. The risk is always that we become complacent, but think about the national economy and how a lot of what we see right now as the country struggles to come out of the downturn is this sort of defensive crouch. So businesses, for example, have access to liquidity. They have cash reserves, but they're not hiring, they're not investing. And if you go talk to them, they say, well, it's because we're not sure what's going to happen with Obamacare. We're not sure what's going to happen in European markets. And maybe they're being a little too deferential to their anxiety. But I think if you could encourage them to have a little more confidence and to be a little more forward-looking, we would see some progress in those areas. So Texas kind of swagger. I don't mind it. I don't find it off-putting. And I think it was important to have chief in that title, too, because I think that one thing about the state is because it's a low cost of living, it's still a middle-class state, and all the cities are middle-class cities. That's different from a big city like New York, where the median apartment price is, four times higher than it is in Houston to buy a house.
So let me ask you about the town of West. People are using that as an example of that's the price you pay for low regulation and gutting the budgets for the regulators.
Right. I mean, I think in looking at West, and we'll wait and see what happens when the investigation is through, we're going to see a story, though, of a multiplicity of failures on the part of the company, on the part of state and federal regulators, not so much the regulations themselves. I mean, we already know the company was out of compliance with a lot of regulations, both state and federal regulations, but a failure of oversight and enforcement. And I think that is a problem, and this is going to be a serious reminder that we need to not underfund that, because this can have very serious consequences. But taking the more macro view, if you look at overall workplace fatalities for 2012, we have complete data. We have a large number of those, too high, but we have about 9% of the countries. This is from the BLS, the Bureau of Labor Statistics. So our share of workplace fatalities corresponds to our share of the national economy. And in Texas, as in the rest of the country, the biggest hazard is traffic accidents, transit accidents. So maybe this goes back to your point, David, about texting while driving. But if we want to improve workplace safety, we'll need to include things like highway safety.
And that's a big topic also being tackled by the legislature, trying to get more money for transportation issues. Also, locally with the Eagle Ford Shale, we're seeing so much more traffic on these little roads that were not designed for all this activity.
It's true. And I think some of the challenges we have today are actually challenges that are a result of our growth. I mean, you add 4 million people to the state in the past 10 or 11 years. We're now 26 million. That's going to mean money not just to fix potholes, but to build new roads and new infrastructure.
Yeah, 1,000 new people moving to Texas every single day. Thank you so much for joining us on The Source. Erica Greeter, author of Big, Hot, Cheap, and Right, What America Can Learn from the Strange Genius of Texas. We're out of time. We've got to wrap this up. Thanks to our callers and online participants. You've been listening to The Source on KSTX. Paul Flabb's the show's producer. Wayne Coble is the TPR program director. Chris U. Daly is our web producer. I get production help from Catherine Dixon. I'm David Martin Davies. Join us on the line at tpr.org. The conversation continues. Support for The Source comes from the contributors to the Community Engagement Fund, including the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.